Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. The Florida Project might be the first Sean Baker movie you see in theaters, but he has been on the scene for a long, long time. Perhaps best known for the iPhone 5S film's Tangerine, Baker has been a champion of low-budget filmmaking for his entire career. More so than that, he has been a trailblazer in the democratization of film. Inspired by the Dogma 95 movement, created by the Danish directors Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg, he is known for making best use of the resources available to him. Take Out, The Prince of Broadway, and yes, Tangerine were all shot on minuscule budgets with minimal crew and whatever gear they could afford to shoot on. His latest film, The Florida Project, breaks this trend, but keeps the Dogma 95 spirit well alive. It's his first film to be granted a million-dollar budget, and shot on 35mm, every frame oozes with beauty. If any director were to make the fullest use of the medium he shot on, Baker would be it. The film is set over one summer in Celebration, Florida, the home of Disney World. It follows the everyday adventures of precocious 6-year-old Mooney, a child whose mother lives month to month in a motel and does some less than favorable things to make rent. Baker and I discuss his long road through obscurity, the level of discipline every filmmaker should aspire to own, and how, even when no one else believes in you, you can still believe in yourself. Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and I am here with Sean Baker, director of The Florida Project. How are you doing today, Sean?
Good, thanks for having me.
No problem, it's an honor. Let's start off by, I'm going to ask, you went to film school, right?
I did, yeah, NYU.
NYU.
Tisch,
cool.
Undergrad.
Very cool. For undergrad, though.
Yes, yes.
And what kind of things were you learning? When was that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, sorry.
A long time ago in a galaxy far away.
Yeah.
Now, a very long time ago, actually. I graduated. I'm not going to say a year, but let's just say I graduated with, like, Todd Phillips, Mark Forster, those guys.
Okay, that works for me.
Yeah, yeah.
What were some of the things that you took away from film school back then?
When I first was leaving film school, I realized that it was way more about the people you were meeting there than the education you were receiving.
Right.
Equipment was very important, the access to equipment at the time. And I started to think, I could have done this at my community college. And I kind of still think that way.
Yeah.
Hope NYU isn't listening. I think it's all about the people you are working with. So I always told people, hey, it doesn't matter if you're going to school or not, as long as you just go hang out with the people mm-hmm. who are actually going and get on their crews, you know, and learn that way. Because that's exactly what you're doing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you're learning from working together and forming relationships that you will be hopefully. And in my case, yes, it did work out. You'll have for the rest of your life. I mean, Chris Bergosh and I met at NYU, and I graduated. Now, this is where I truly age myself, but I graduated literally when digital was just kicking in. Mm-hmm. So I actually edited films on a Steam Deck mm-hmm. with tape and a razor blade, and and I actually had to go back to school. I started learning nonlinear just because my friends had systems in the mid-90s. But I went back to school to officially learn the Avid, and I went to the New School for continuing studies over there, whatever they call it. And that's where I met Xiqing Zhou, who was doing grad work there. She got her graduate degree from there. So two relationships that I feel, and no, not only that, the Greg the Bunny guys. So I have many relationships that stem from schools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you meet the Greg the Bunny guys at the
NYU?
New School? Oh, at NYU.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Dan Milano and Spencer Chenoy, and Spencer and I were roommates senior year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did you find that those projects that you were working on at NYU sort of informed the projects that you'd later be working on in your career in terms of thematically or...
No.
No?
Those guys were. Dan and his circle, they were already doing puppet shows during their sight and sound video classes and stuff like that. So they, yes, thematically, they were already set down that road. My stuff, my senior film, the films that I worked on really, if you look at them now, had very little to do with what I'm doing. Yeah. Yeah, but I think what happened with NYU is more about my time to be in such a wonderful city that provided me with ways of almost self-educating.
Right.
So I had the retrospective theaters, I had Anthology Film Archives, that was major in my life. I had the Film Society of Lincoln Center with all the wonderful festivals. I had Kim's Video.
R.I.P.
Yeah, all of them. So it was a great time to be in New York because you just had right now is a great time too.
Okay.
Like there was a moment in there where it got a little hairy.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, like I live in L.A. now and I look at all like these amazing theaters, Nighthawk and Metrograph and the Quad is now amazing. So I look at, like, I'm jealous.
Yeah.
Because we lost CineFamily. We lost CineFamily in L.A. We don't really have a lot going. I mean, we have a lot in L.A., of course. But I'm kind of jealous of what's going on in New York.
So I caught your IFP talk a few weeks ago at Brick. I was there.
Oh, okay. I was tired that morning. Oh, I don't even remember what I said.
As was I. It was ridiculous waking up at like 10 a.m. Yeah. That was the first event. Yes. So I had to go pick up my badge before that.
Boy.
9 a.m.?
Yeah.
Anyways, you bring up L.A. now. And one of the things that you said at that screening or the talk, yeah. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
Is you said that once you hit L.A., you kind of don't look back in terms of you lived in New York City. You still have an apartment in New York City,
yeah,
right?
But yeah, because it's rent stabilized.
Okay.
I sublet it out. But L.A. does, there's no doubt about it, it puts you in the world of the industry.
Okay.
Now, look, you can have an independent film career here, obviously. Look at Spike Lee and Jarmusch, and you know it works here. It totally works here. But there was the proximity for me helped me out. I think I don't know whether it was the time in my life or the fact that I actually felt myself closer to, you know, colleagues and peers that were working in my field, and I wanted to, you know, I felt almost like a stronger sense of community there. And not slamming the New York's film community. I'm just saying that that was the time where I felt like I was finally interacting with other filmmakers. And so I found inspiration there.
When do you think would be a good time for an aspiring filmmaker to move to LA? Does he have to have like an established feature out? Does it make?
No, I think it really depends on what sort of work you want to do. Mm-hmm. And your career path that you want to take. I mean, look at all the filmmakers who live in Austin now.
Right.
I mean, they're obviously doing great, and they have a sense of community there. And so it really depends. I mean, look, if you want to go right into TV, and you have studio films, obviously, you go there fast. You know, I never had that desire, and so. Even living there now is more about quality of life. My income level is just an independent filmmaker, so it actually is cheaper to live there.
Yeah.
And also being in the unions, it helps out. I'm very close to the DGA, and there's lots of, you know, for me, it provides me with a lot of events and screenings. And so I don't know. It really, really comes down to your career path.
Well, I'm like, I say this just, you know, considering making a move out there myself. I don't know anyone out there really.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think, you know, like you say, it's about, I guess, the relationships that you'll forge there. Do you have to have relationships in place, or did you find it easy to sort of like make new relationships?
I did find it easy to make new relationships. I mean, you have people who are all struggling. They're trying to break in. So you're surrounding yourself with other people who are like-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And there does seem to be, you know, to a certain degree, a social, you know, uprising there where I see that there are more events for filmmakers. You have Film Independent out there. It's very strong. I mean, I know, you know, IFP is here. Mm-hmm. And it's the same sort of thing. If you're going down the route of an agency, you want to find an agent, and you're going to be working within the system.
Mm-hmm.
If you're there, you're getting way more meetings. You can find financiers and producers easier.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that okay. to take into consideration.
Well, then let's step back to New York and your work here.
Right.
After college, you know, you are a prolific filmmaker, and you know, a lot of people. I think you have six features, right?
Yes.
This is your sixth feature. Yes. And I was wondering, you know, from graduating NYU to making your first feature, what were the steps that you had to go through to make that movie?
Well, it was at a time where people were still shooting on film exclusively. There was no video yet.
Right.
Not even standard def. Dogma 95 didn't kick in yet. So it was at a time where you would have to shoot on film. And so I was lucky enough to land a job. It was a very, you know, it was just one of those, like, right out of school, finding a small publishing company that put me in charge of their AV work. So basically I was producing a lot of corporate type videos. I was interviewing authors, traveling all over the States just to interview them and then put together a little EPK, right? But that's good. That's good work. I mean, it pays the bills. And I would suggest anybody who is striving to become a filmmaker to stay within your, at least in the AV world, because you're practicing on a daily basis. And even though it feels like, oh, this isn't me being creative, it is. It really is, because you're still framing shots. You're still editing. You're still getting, you know, understanding the technical side of things. So, and trust me, I've gone to places where I've even spent how long? About 6 months editing and shooting wedding videos. I mean, what felt like the lowest part of my, like, I can't get any lower. I'm doing wedding videos. But that, looking back on it, even though at the time I was just like, this is really, I can't get any lower. Looking back, it was actually a time in which there was a lot of growth. I was spending the time to edit these wedding videos in a way that was like, I was putting my heart into them.
Yeah.
You know, and not only that, I was actually getting to, in a sociological way, I was going to all these weddings from people from different backgrounds. And I even wrote a script that hasn't been produced yet, but was about a Russian wedding, because of the amount of, you know, you live in New York, and of, like, the weddings that I had to go out in Brighton Beach.
Yeah.
And they were so unique and so wonderful, so fun and so full of character that, like, as somebody who's a writer, it was giving me so much material. So at the time, yes, wanted to kill myself. And you know, looking back in hindsight, I actually got a lot from it. So sticking in the world of, you know, in this industry to a certain degree, I think that going off and, you know, and being doing something outside of your industry is, if you can, you know, if you can pay the bills with doing corporate videos or editing or whatever you can, I would say do that over doing something completely unrelated, because it's still practice. You're still, and again, I'm the type of filmmaker who thinks that a director should know almost all aspects of technology, of you know, the technological aspects of filmmaking. I really feel like a director should know how to turn on a freaking camera. I've met too many directors who can't even turn on a camera, which is embarrassing. You know, I think that a director should understand shooting, not be a master DP. No, obviously not. But know how to capture an image. You know, should know how to edit on one of the nonlinear systems. You should know Final Cut, or you should know the Avid. You know, because what it comes down to is that this is a director-driven art, right? I mean, one person eventually it falls into a director's lap, and you should be able to, you know, jump on the editing system or the camera or whatever it takes to actually. It's like a painter not knowing how to pick up a brush.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I totally went off on a tangent.
No,
there.
No, that was great. I mean, it's even more a thing to know every aspect of production if you're working on your first passion project.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know?
Because people are, you can't expect everyone to ever have the amount of passion you'll have for that. They're not being paid enough.
Yeah.
You know, they're simply, you can't even, I mean, there are, of course, those really special personalities out there, those producers who are with you no matter what. But it's asking a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because the amount, when you break down the, when you really break it down and you're saying like, how much did I actually make making this feature? It's usually, well, if that's, if you're not paying for it, if you're paying for it yourself, you're usually losing money.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even in the sense that, even in a place where you're getting like your director's minimums from the union. So I get, say I just am a director and I have a DGA minimum coming in for a feature.
Right.
Okay. You break that down over 3 years of time and you are working almost like 6 days a week and it's 12 hours a day sometimes, you're basically making minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it's more than that too, because you're constantly thinking about these things. So
your amount of stress, you're killing yourself. There's that whole effect too.
So become a filmmaker.
Yeah. but ultimately though, then you look at it and you're like, okay, but I am in the position, you have to stay positive because like you're in a position in which, wow, you actually are able to work in this art form. It's the most expensive art form. It takes a lot of luck and a lot of right timing and a lot of like, you know, years and years of being driven and ultimately it's like, you know, but I'm in a place of privilege. I'm being able to do this, and this is really something that I should be thankful for, because, you know, so many people are not in that position. They are going through, they have jobs that they can't wait until 5 p.m. They just want to go home and forget about it. We go home, we don't go home. Sometimes our, you know, we live with our work for 3 years straight, and then it's on to the next one, you know? And so these are our babies, these are our children. And so if you think about it, it's like we are like career long parents. That's our thing, you know. It's weird. It's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, especially for you, you know, you're making movies. I feel like every single one of your movies has been a passion project in some way. Like it's come from you.
Yeah. Well, I think I just look at the directors that I admire and the films that I admire, and they're always passion projects.
Yeah.
I mean, did Kubrick ever make a film that wasn't a passion project? No, probably not. Mm-hmm. You know. So they have to be. They should be. Yeah.
And then, so I feel like another thing that you can do to sort of, you know, there's a certain amount of luck, of course. Mm. But this whole preparedness thing we were talking about, by, you know, sort of investing as much energy in your day job. If you can, there's like a ton of day jobs today.
Yep.
That, I mean, the way that video content is exploding.
Exactly.
All over the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just crazy.
Yeah, there's opportunities out there to become, what are they used to call? They used to call them predators, right? Where you're a producer. What is that?
That's what I am.
That's what you are. I'm looking at one.
I'm a predator. Yeah.
But you know, there are so many outlets right now that rely on video content, that rely on, you know, audio content, and so it's a new world. You know, journalism has fallen into an AV world to a certain degree, and so yes, there are way more opportunities. I was lucky at the time out of NYU to have this publishing company, and all my other friends were struggling.
Yeah.
They were waiters and waitresses and or hardly working in the field in the industry whatsoever. They were like, they were struggling to get any job, and I was in a place where I was very blessed to have this thing in which it actually, I landed a commercial. Getting back to that whole thing.
Sure.
I landed a commercial just because it was just a connection. It was just simply a connection I made at this job. It's always about connections. It's always about meeting people. You know, that is one, that's another thing about LA. You're out and you're meeting people, right? You're in the industry. So anyway, but at this publishing company, I got one commercial.
Yeah.
I talked them into allowing me to shoot it on Super 16. So it looked really good at the time. And that commercial, even though it didn't even air, they didn't even have the budget to like air it for some weird reason. It ended up, that was the first thing that went onto my reel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually got a real commercial out of it. And it wasn't a huge commercial. It was a small toy company.
Mm-hmm.
But it put like 50 grand in my pocket. That 50 grand, I didn't spend a, a cent of it. It went right into buying all the raw stock from Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys.
That's awesome.
It was all, it was like their leftover stock. And at the time, it was their fastest Kodak stock. It was the fastest Kodak stock. So I could shoot at night and get an exposure at night. I don't even think those stocks are available anymore. That's the sad part.
Probably not.
Because Kodak only makes like two or three stocks and they don't do the fast ones. So this allowed me to shoot some stuff at night, and I made this little social realist Kevin Smithy type movie. No, it was actually a social realist Kevin Smith film in a way. Not inspired by Kevin Smith. It's just it happened to be that I wanted to focus on guys in the suburbs, and I'm also from Jersey. So I think we had a similar sensibility that way. But it's called Four Letter Words. It was called – had several names. It actually went to – South by Southwest in 2000.
Okay.
So that was my first sort of that's what sort of validated me in a way. It was like, oh wow, okay, I'm being taken seriously here. I made a feature. It got to South by. At the same time, I had this television show that I was a co-creator on, Greg the Bunny, and that is again a lesson in putting your work out there, and doing something to, you know, the industry won't come. You know, Mark Duplass had that wonderful keynote speech at South by Southwest where he's like, the Calvary is not going to come. You know, it's not there. You have to put your work out there. You have to prove yourself. And what we did with Greg the Bunny, this was before YouTube, because now people have so many platforms. But at the time, there was only public access. Mm-hmm. That was the only way to show your film to the your work to the public for free. And we put our Greg the Bunny episodes up on Public Access Manhattan Neighborhood Network, it was called at the time, maybe it still is, and suddenly we were getting calls, and agencies were actually watching that stuff. So we got on IFC, and we were shooting little like interstitial, like these little interstitial episodes that parodied the independent films that they were showing. Mm-hmm. And we happened to be lovers of film, so we were really into this and having our puppets parody independent movies like Blue Velvet and I don't know. We even did autofocus. And by the way, I still have to show Willem that. I don't think he's ever seen it. And Paul Schrader hasn't seen it either. Wow. I can't wait till they do. Anyway, but so that kept me afloat. And that was where I didn't have to get a 9-to-5 either, because that was helping me along. And then I got Four Letter Words into South By. It got a small DVD release, which I didn't even get paid for, but it was keeping me going.
Right.
And that's when Dogma 95 kicked in.
Can you define Dogma 95?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
No problem. Just for...
It's a film movement that I guess came out of perhaps Denmark and in that area by a bunch of filmmakers, including, you know, Lars von Trier and Vindenberg, the guy who made Celebration and Susanna Bear. Can you please fact check these?
I'll fact check. I'll cut anyone's that aren't in.
Thanks. Thank you. So, but at the time it was this, I guess this, it was this semi, I guess they could say it was their movement. It was a way of saying, look, let's make films. There was a goal behind it. It was about finding, I guess, truth in filmmaking. So they said you can shoot it on standard definition film. They had a manifesto and a bunch of rules that were supposed to be followed. But what it did to me is that it really inspired me. And I always, to this day, I consider Lars von Trier's Dogma 95 film, The Idiots, is one of my favorite films and most I consider it one of the best films ever made. And I said, wow, if I can look at this film that's shot on standard definition and doesn't look so beautiful, but it is such a beautiful movie, I can do it too. There's no reason I can't do it. I have access to standard definition cameras. I had, you know, everyone had a mini DV camera at the time. So Xi Qing and I went out and we made Takeout. I mean, we were barely paying rent at the time. I mean, it was that bad. This was between IFC, between Greg the Bunny seasons. And we said, we're going to make something for like $3,000. That was our budget. We shot this movie. It was just the two of us. We wore every hat possible, except, you know, our lead actor, Charles Jang, actually was like our third crew member. He was helping us carry the tripod. You know what I mean? Like, it was really that gorilla and that, you know, minimal in terms of the way we it was truly run and gun, as guerrilla as you get.
Who was, I mean, you were behind the camera?
I was doing camera and sound.
Okay, camera
and sound. Like, I would lob people. We shot in a real takeout on the Upper West Side, so mm-hmm. I lobbed that entire place. So that, you know, we were using real customers coming in and then quickly chasing them down after they made their order, and so that we could get them to sign a release.
Wow.
You know, and you know, the film premiered at Slamdance in 2004, and had a nice life, but we got a distributor, Cavu Pictures, but they didn't have enough money to put it out at the time, and there was a waiting game, and I was getting so impatient. I went ahead and I made Prince of Broadway with some more money that I made off of Greg the Bunny. So I was still paying for my film. So
right.
I had to pay for Four Letter Words, Takeout, and Prince of Broadway. Now, Takeout was only $3,000. Prince of Broadway was $45,000, but you know, I just was like, if I don't keep moving, I'm gonna die here. So I gotta keep making movies. And what happened was that was the time, I think, where it all sort of came together, because I decided that I was gonna spend the rest of my money with doing sort of a hybrid service deal on Takeout, where I was working with the distributor and putting my own money into it to get it into theaters.
Wow.
Now, So it got into theaters at the same time that Prince of Broadway was hitting the festival circuit. Prince of Broadway got a lot of attention from critics, and all of a sudden they said, oh, but he has another feature in theaters right now. And they thought it was like a 1-2 punch, when it actually wasn't. It was actually like 3 years between the two movies. But it seemed like I was prolific.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, on top of that, they were both nominated for the Cassavetes Award the same year, so they actually competed against one another.
Wow.
Kino Lorber, a very prestigious label, which I love, picked up Takeout. Prince of Broadway came out in theaters. Lee Daniels helped us with the release of that by putting his name on it and saying Lee Daniels Presents to get us more traction. So those two came out, Spirit Awards hit, and then suddenly I was in a place where I was like, okay, let's see what happens. And we had our last final season of Greg the Bunny on MTV. It was called Warren the Ape. It was like a spinoff. It died so fast. Nobody knows about it, though it's, I would recommend. It's kind of funny, actually.
I'm gonna check it out. Yeah.
It was Snooki. It was killed us because it was the second season of Jersey Shore. And they were like, their ratings were like 5 million a night or something, and ours was like less than 250,000. Like, ours were, we were dead in the water.
Man.
So we were quickly canceled. But what happened was that I was spent that year in LA, and it inspired me, and I was like, I want to live here. And plus, I being on Warren, I met all these adult film stars because we were doing cameos, and I was like, I'm going to make a social realist little cinema verite film about an adult film star. And so Chris and I, I went to New York, wrote Starlet with him. And by that time, because I think of what happened with Takeout and Prince of Broadway, we were able to get financing finally. And then all of a sudden, Dree Hemingway comes my way, because of her manager loving Prince of Broadway. So it proved that, like, all that, like, me putting my own money into it and, like, will I ever get a break? Yes, in hindsight, it actually did work. Like, all my self-investment in my own projects actually got me to a place where suddenly, finally, I had a financier. Finally, I had, Mariel's daughter, Ernest's great-granddaughter, starring in my film. And, you know, it was just finally the ball was rolling. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm going to sum up that led to Duplass and loving, you know, coming up to the next film. And then, of course, Tangerine leading to this film. So it was like, it was years of just like a lot of almost giving up, but feeling that if I don't invest in myself, nobody will.
Yeah.
And I think that, if anything, is what I say to, like, people. You just got to keep going and putting your product out there, because you got to keep proving yourself. People aren't just going to come and just throw money at you until they see actually potential, and, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm sorry for being so long-winded there.
No, are you kidding me? I mean, it just seems like You know, you, if no one else is going to believe in you, you have to believe in yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I do have a really great team around me, and they've been very supportive over the years, and I've loved collaborating with them. So you, it's also about finding, you know, those people that you really connect with and have a similar sensibility, and people that you can, yeah, again, rely on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, we like, I could spend another half hour talking
yeah,
with you. We
sorry
didn't even get to
that.
Florida Project. But,
sorry.
You know?
Well, let me just say Florida Project is coming out October 6th in New York and LA.
Yeah.
It's my biggest film yet. I finally got over the $1 million mark in terms of a budget. If you add up all the budgets of the previous films, they don't even reach a million.
No, I'm sure they're nowhere close.
And suddenly I was able to finally make a movie for a couple million. A beautiful distributor by the name of A24. You may have heard them. They're about them. They're putting it out. and the film then, you know, rolls out. We go wider the second weekend, October 13th, and you'll see it and hopefully in your home city, and it's shot for the big screen. I just want to emphasize that. Alexis Zabe, who shot it, is an amazing cinematographer. We shot this on 35 millimeter. It should be seen on the big screen. And
absolutely,
if you love The Little Rascals, I think you'll really connect with this movie. And fun with it.
I will go on record saying that it's my favorite movie I've seen this year. So, I've seen a lot of movies.
Wow.
I was blown away.
Oh,
and
well, thank you.
Many of
so
my
much.
Friends also say that. So,
that means so
you know,
much. Thank you.
This whole Dogma 95 thing makes total sense as to, you know, Tangerine and like you essentially starting the democratization of film in a lot of ways.
Well, I was inspired by Dogma, and if my use of the iPhone on Tangerine has inspired others, well, that's just a wonderful thing. That's awesome.
Thank you so much for talking with us today,
Sean.
Cool.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. The Florida Project is out in New York and LA now and will be expanding to theaters nationwide by the end of the month. Definitely go see it on the big screen and you'll have yourself an incredible experience. If you like our interview episodes, go ahead and subscribe to the whole No Film School podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever podcast platform you use. And if you really like us, you can slap us with a 5-star rating on iTunes. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me on Twitter at Jim_John_Jim. And we will see you Thursday for Indie Film Weekly.